The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Georgine Rice, and it's great to be with you on this 4th of July weekend. This week, abortion before the nation's highest court. And this past week, pro-lifers received a disappointing decision.
Even though he thought that decision was completely wrong, he now says, well, but once we make a decision, we have to stick with it.
We'll look at Associate Justice Clarence Thomas in dissent.
Our abortion precedents are grievously wrong and should be overruled.
And in this time of pandemic and social unrest, many have sensed a double standard at play. One set of rules for religious gatherings and an entirely different set of rules for protesters. A New York judge agreed.
He issued an injunction blocking the governor's executive order that literally discriminated against houses of worship.
And amidst violent unrest, statues are coming down across the nation. Is the current unrest leading us toward constructive change? Or is it a push for some sort of leftist revolution? Victor Davis Hanson.
Who would ever have thought 6 weeks ago people might want to destroy Mount Rushmore?
We've got all this and more. I'm Georgine Rice, your host, and it's great to be with you. Coming to you from Portland, Oregon, in my home station at KPDQ. You can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon at 93.9 FM here in Portland and online via our website at kpdq.com and through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us. We'll start at the Supreme Court. Now, it's no great mystery that in recent years, a great deal of attention has gone to our nation's highest court. They're hearing cases directly related to the most hotly contested issues in the nation today, including the issue of life and the infamous Roe versus Wade decision from 1973 and the lethal legacy left in its wake. Well, since 1973 and the Roe decision, and especially since 1992 and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the pro-life cause has been making incremental progress on the right to life, including in Louisiana, a law that protected women by requiring abortion clinics to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles. By a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court overturned that law. We'll let Denise Harley of Alliance Defending Freedom explain. She was a guest of Kevin McCullough on AM 570, The Mission in New York City.
Did not come out the way we wanted to. Why?
I think that, from what I can tell, the controlling opinion is Chief Justice Roberts' concurrence. He concurred only in the judgment. He did not agree with the four liberal justices in their reasoning. His bottom line was that this is very similar, in his view, to the Texas case that was decided in 2016. And that was basically his reasoning. He said this is a very similar law, similar facts. And even though he thought that decision was completely wrong back 3.5 years ago, he now says, well, but once we make a decision, we have to stick with it.
So the whole stare decisis thing.
This whole stare decisis, which sometimes they like it, sometimes they don't.
Yeah, well, let's talk about it for a second, Denise, because for people that were not following the Supreme Court docket very carefully, this Louisiana law that was decided, what was the, in essence, claim as to why the state of Louisiana wanted to put it in place to begin with?
Well, Louisiana had a track record of abortion providers there offering substandard care, botched abortions, failure to report harm to women, destruction of medical records, no sanitizing instruments, and on and on and on. So Louisiana legislature, in an overwhelming bipartisan bill, passed a measure that simply required abortion providers to meet the same standards that apply to other outpatient surgical doctors throughout the state, which is to have admitting privileges to a hospital. And what that does is pretty much ensures a certain level of competence, and it ensures that women, when something goes wrong during abortion, can have a continuity of care. And the abortion businesses challenged this law. No women came forward to challenge this law. Abortion businesses saw that it might hurt their bottom line and make it a little more inconvenient for them. And so they launched this challenge and fought it all the way to the Supreme Court.
I'm frustrated with Roberts. Why is he so doggedly committed to this idea that stare decisis must be always looked out for, when on the substance of a law, you have very obvious and very weak underpinnings for even the people with standing to be making the argument, much less the argument itself?
It's surprising coming from him, because if you look at his vehement dissent in 2016 against the Texas law, he very much is saying kind of what you're saying now. And that case even had a weaker record than the Louisiana case did. So it is surprising. It seems to be some sort of institutional concern in his mind to try to preserve reliability in the court. I guess once we make a mistake, we need to keep making the same mistake. But I will say there's a positive takeaway, and that is that he shot down in his concurrence this idea that there's some new heightened scrutiny. That's the talking point that the abortion industry has been saying since the 2016 Texas case. Oh, this is even higher than Casey. It's now we really have to balance these factors and weigh it. And pretty much you always strike down a pro-life law under this new test. And Roberts was very clear. Nope. Nothing has changed since 1992. States are completely able to enact pro-life laws to protect life, to protect health and safety. And so I think there is pushback in a way that is going to play out in court cases that are going on right now that abortion clinics have brought. And so I'm hopeful for that.
Though this is undoubtedly a setback, this is no time to shrink back from the cause of life. For courage and inspiration, we need look no further than Associate Justice Clarence Thomas, who spoke clearly and with conviction in his dissent. Here's Bob Burney from WRFD, The Word, in Columbus.
In the decision where the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision led by Chief Justice John Roberts, struck down a very reasonable Louisiana abortion law, Clarence Thomas wrote one of the dissensions. And listen to what he says, and I quote, "Today, a majority of the court perpetuates its ill-founded abortion jurisprudence by enjoining a perfectly legitimate state law and doing so without jurisdiction. Our abortion precedents are grievously wrong and should be overruled." You want to know where Clarence Thomas stands on Roe versus Wade? You don't have to wonder anymore. He said, "The high court has neither jurisdiction nor constitutional authority to declare Louisiana's duly enacted law unconstitutional." Clarence Thomas has a keen understanding of the relationship between states and the federal government and the judiciary. Clarence Thomas understands that the Supreme Court is never to legislate. They interpret the law. He went on, and again, I quote, "As is often the case with legal challenges to abortion regulations, this suit was brought by abortionists and abortion clinics. Their sole claim before this court is that Louisiana's law violates the purported substantive due process right of a woman to abort her unborn child. But they concede that this right does not belong to them, and they seek to vindicate no private rights of their own. Under a proper understanding of Article 3, these plaintiffs lack standing to invoke our jurisdiction. Those decisions created the right to abortion out of whole cloth, without a shred of support from the Constitution's text. Our abortion precedents are grievously wrong and should be overruled." This is Justice Clarence Thomas.
All of the action from the Supreme Court has been playing out, as we well know, amidst a pandemic and a nation experiencing widespread civil unrest. With a lethal combination of coronavirus and violent protests, many have sensed a double standard. Government efforts to address COVID-19 seem to hold religious groups to one standard and protesters to another. If you've sensed that double standard, Gary Sharp, a federal judge in New York, agrees with you. Matt Staver from Liberty Counsel joined Don Crow of WAVA in Washington, D.C.
Talk, if you would, first about the New York case involving the governor, the attorney general, and Mayor de Blasio. Kind of flesh out the background of that story and what's happened there.
Well, this is a good decision by a federal judge, and he issued an injunction blocking the governor's executive order that literally discriminated against houses of worship, requiring only 10 people to be able to attend a service, a religious service. no matter the size of the facility, whether it seats 100 or 10,000, doesn't matter. You can only have 10. But on the other hand, exempting other secular businesses, putting a percentage which allows many more people with the any kind of secular gathering. In fact, it's clear discrimination against religious worship. But the other issue is they pointed out how the governor and the mayor both discriminated in favor of protests that they agreed with. And so they actually encouraged people to participate in the recent protest, yet at the same time continuing to restrict churches to only 10 people. So this federal court order found that that discrimination was unconstitutional, violated the First Amendment, and ruled in favor of the churches as well as the synagogues on the First Amendment issue and against the governor and against Mayor de Blasio. It's a great decision.
Systemic religious discrimination. Do you think there is such a thing growing in our culture?
Absolutely. And in fact, we're filing three briefs today on behalf of three different churches in different states, Virginia, Kentucky, and also Maine, at the various courts of appeal, three in one day. And in all of those cases, here's a clear example, and it's the same in every one of these states. They distinguish between not only what you can do in religious services and outside secular meetings, but they also discriminate in the church service itself, in the church building. So in these cases, you can have an unlimited number of people in your church for secular meetings to feed them, shelter them overnight, and provide social services, which could be counseling to apply for unemployment benefits and you name it. But as soon as you turn to a religious service, you have these restrictions kicking in, even if it's the same people, the same players, wow, and the same church building. So it's very clear that we have a systemic discrimination against churches and houses of worship in every one of these executive orders.
And it seems to me that of all the people involved in this hypocrisy, Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio, I think, are right out in front of everybody in terms of, I mean, we know what Governor Cuomo did regarding nursing homes. It becomes sort of the cause celebre in a negative way as to what not to do.
Yeah, and Mayor de Blasio, just a few weeks ago, he heard that this Jewish funeral was taken by a small group of people. He ended up driving over there, and he then tweeted how he was proud of himself that he personally got out and interrupted that Jewish funeral and told them to stop because they had more than 10 people. Yet at the same time, he's encouraging hundreds and thousands of people to gather together for these Black Lives Matters so-called protests that are taking place. That's discriminatory. It really shows that these orders are politically driven. They impose them when they want to. They violate them when they want to, and the target is religion, and particularly houses of worship. If you look at Governor Cuomo, his people that are doing the tracing of these coronavirus tests and so forth, they're told specifically, do not ask people if they attended a protest. We know that thousands and thousands of people, in some cases, like in Chicago, 30,000 people were part of a protest, no social distancing. And of course, you don't hear anything about that being a cause of the rise of coronavirus. And yet, isn't it interesting? It was after the protest that all these numbers started to go up.
Coming up, a look at this revolutionary moment.
Who would ever have thought 6 weeks ago people might want to destroy Mount Rushmore?
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis is straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Georgine Rice. On May 25th, just a few short weeks ago, George Floyd lost his life while in police custody in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And for one brief moment, the nation rallied in a unified call for justice. Images of Floyd's life being drained away were repulsive, and the offending officer, we all agreed, must be held accountable. Sadly, what we have witnessed over the last 6 weeks has moved well past George Floyd and even beyond race relations. What we're watching is something else entirely, and we would do well to pay attention. Veteran historian and prolific writer Victor Davis Hanson joined Don Crow to explain.
You observe that while the president's opponents have been seeing this upcoming election as a chance to, you know, get Washington back to their self-serving idea of normalcy, if you will, The president and his base, all of us in that category, have been saying this is our last chance to drain the swamp. And now you say this is ancient history. So what can we expect instead as this focus has shifted over the last few weeks as to what we're really going to be fighting over in November?
The opposition now has not presented an alternate agenda yet, and it's not within the realm of traditional Democratic Republican politics. It's almost a French Revolutionary start again at year zero. And by that I mean suddenly in the space of, what, 4 or 5 weeks, all of our references are now taboo. Who would ever have thought 6 weeks ago people might want to destroy Mount Rushmore? Even the DNC had said that it was illegitimate, basically tweeted that out. Who thought that you couldn't listen to Joan Baez the night they drove Dixie down, or watch Gone with the Wind, or go to a park and see a statue of Father Sarah or Columbus, or watch a particular cartoon? Or who would know that people would be scouring your email, your public statements, to find something that you might have inadvertently said either privately or publicly 8, 10, 12, 30 years ago in the case of some comedians that would now come back and be used to destroy your career? So this is a holistic, systemic effort to remake the United States. And 1776 is out with these people. It's 1619. And Washington and Jefferson are out. And it's Malcolm X and Saul Alinsky. So we have a whole new charade of heroes, of statues, of names. But what I'm getting at is we haven't seen revolutions like this in this country analogous to the Chinese Cultural Revolution or, you know, the French Revolution or something like the Salem Witch Trial.
And would you agree, Victor, that we really are at that watershed moment that so many of us for decades have been watching and developing and even concerned about, but we're often, if not excoriated for the view, at least laughed at, that this really is a cultural moment in which the nation's being brought down to choosing between an actual major shift from the kind of economy and capitalistic society on which we were built to a true socialist Marxist country. I mean, many folks say that never will happen, but here we are.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we can distill what the Democratic unsuccessful message was in January, February, March, and the primaries, and how it will be brought in the back door through a vice presidential candidate. And that was Medicare for everybody, reparations, the New Green Deal, open borders, the abolition of ICE. And that's been glued on now. It's gone much further now, so that people are talking about structural changes in the Constitution should they win the Senate. At least they would try. I mean, there's nothing in the U.S. Constitution that says you have to have 9 people on the Supreme Court. It's been there since, I think, 1867, but all the major candidates said they wanted 12, 16 Supreme Court judges. There'll be an effort to get rid of the Electoral College. There's been talk about making senators popularly elected rather than 2 from each state, which the left feels is unfair. I could go on, but they have a whole agenda to change the Constitution in a way that the founders deliberately were afraid of. And when you hear them writing about Mount Rushmore, that it's glorifying white supremacy, then everything, there's nothing sacrosanct. Everything is up for negotiation. If you don't want to negotiate, it'll be torn down. Whether it's Ulysses S. Grant or Robert Lee, it doesn't matter whose side was on which side. And I think that was a failure of establishment Republicans. They thought they could contain it, negotiate it, contextualize it by just saying, well, we'll just tear down all the Confederate statues, or we won't play Ken Burns' Civil War anymore, or we won't listen to Dixie anymore, we promise, or we'll get rid of. But it was an escalating demand, and they didn't understand that. It didn't have anything to do with those issues. Nobody in Chicago is going to die or live today depending on whether there's a statue in Charlottesville or Virginia. It just doesn't, there's not a connection.
And what I inferred from some of what you've written is that although this crisis, ongoing, growing, it's just metastasizing in the culture now, politically and otherwise, it really was triggered by the George Floyd murder, but quickly that faded into the background, and that's not the issue really now. Even race relations is much bigger. Am I right?
I think so. I've been looking at some of the videos and pictures from these demonstrations, and It's very scary how George Floyd's name has disappeared. And they're now, they have communist sloganeering or eat the rich or end white privilege or white supremacy. But it's on to a much more ambitious agenda that we only really see in the university heretofore. I mean, I've seen it and I've dealt with it as a faculty member for 30 years, but it was always esoteric and confined to the university sociology department or African studies or gender studies. Now it's out in the open, and partly it's a result of the lockdown, I think, and the pent-up emotions, but partly it's people saw that there wasn't going to be a pushback. And once they started going, everybody kind of sold their soul. We had generals who said, suddenly wanted to weigh in and virtue signal and said, let's change Fort Benning. Let's change Fort Bragg. Let's take down Robert E. Lee. I'll do my part. And then we had actors, and then we had people at our workplaces, our schools. Each person thought, I will be saved from this, and I will be exempt, or I will profit from it if I can join it without thinking. And they ended up just in the classic, you know, Jacobin French revolutionary cycle. And it won't end until the elite who started it pay a price, and that would be 2,000 or 3,000 indictments of the people who organize this violence or topple statues, because many of them are upper middle class and don't want to go to jail. Or the middle class says, you know what, you can call me any name in the book you want, and you can say anything about you, but I'm not going to vote for this, and I'm not going to endorse this, and I'm going to remember what you did. Or the NFL coaching staff and all the players take a knee, and they won't even rise to a national anthem. People will just say, I'm not going to watch it. I'm not going to attend a game. And that type of resistance we haven't seen yet.
What does the president have to do to end, as you put it in one of your columns, the current cultural revolution? In other words, he assumed he was going to be fighting someone he sees as no threat whatsoever, Joe Biden and whoever may run with him. And yet that's not really his battleground now, is it?
No, it isn't. And he's not getting a lot of help, because whether they act it or not doesn't matter. The perception is that his polls are down in the 41, 42 points. So Joe Biden feels that they have gone down the longer that he's not been out on the campaign trail, and the more that his surrogates have, and the media have attacked Trump, and the Republicans are afraid they in the House and Senate that if they were to get out in the vanguard and try to stop this cultural revolution, that they might be consumed by it.
Coming up, a closer look at A People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn.
He is not a legitimate historian or a scholar. He is a communist propagandist.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. The Christian Outlook podcast brought to you in partnership with Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose religious freedom is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-654-3969. 3969. That's 800-654-3969, or click on the banner ad at christianoutlook.com. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Georgine Rice. In our last segment, Victor Davis Hanson noted how he witnessed the kind of thinking we're seeing in today's protest movement during his time as a university professor in California. But now those college grads have literally taken those ideas to the street. Where do they find their inspiration? Well, one of the books that has shaped generations of high school and college students is A People's History of the United States by the late Howard Zinn. The author Mary Graybar, who also writes for The Federalist, is pushing back with her own volume, debunking Howard Zinn. She was a guest on my program. You write in the, I think it's in the preface of the book, about the context in which this book emerged. There were a number of historians who were discredited at that time as his book was about to come out, and somehow his emerged and flourished when a number of historians were discredited, even though he's not a great historian. And even critics who would agree with some of his priorities had to say that this is not a good work of history.
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's Michael Kazin, you know, well-known leftist. And when he reviewed the book, he called it more appropriate to a conspiracy monger's website than to a history book. Yeah, so it was criticized on the left as well. I mean, by any standard measure of history writing, what's in a people's history is fraudulent. It's, you know, it's not backed up by statistics. It, you know, promotes rumors, a conspiracy theory. He takes quotations out of context. He makes speakers say the opposite of what they really did say. And up until now, no one has really gone through his book and systematically checked it against his sources or what other historians have said. And I did check with historians both on the right and on the left. And I went through his own papers at New York University. I went to the Martin Luther King Center. I went to the Library of Congress and Emory University and did research and discovered that this book is a fraudulent piece of history.
And yet,
deliberately so.
Deliberately yes. So. And yet it is a very popular book. And in the academy, it's embraced in colleges and universities all across the country. The young people who were raised on this book are now lawmakers. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is one example, running on socialist platforms.
Howard, then, he had this ability to write and to touch people's emotions. He did it illegitimately, but he was able to do that. So he has made people cry, you know, after they read a people's history. Some have become angered. He's inspired Antifa.
I think most people assume that once something is in print, if it's embraced by the academy, that there must be good scholarship. Yet even those on either side of the ideological spectrum have acknowledged that Zinn's scholarship is poorly done. And it's hard to imagine how he has succeeded as well as he has, particularly among academics. Is it because he is parroting what they want to hear? How is it that he has managed to resonate with so many, despite the fact that his scholarship is so poor?
I think you pinpointed a large part of that, and this is something that I go into in my book.
Yes.
In 2010, Mitch Daniels, when he was governor of Indiana, had emailed people in education. He learned that Zinn's book was being used in an NEH, National Endowment for the Humanities, summer session for teachers to get continuing education, and he was outraged and expressed it in these emails. Well, these were revealed by a AP reporter in 2013, and by that time, Mitch Daniels was president of Purdue, and Michael Kazin and the other leftists who had criticized Zinn now attacked Mitch Daniels. I mean, it's truly amazing, you know, how they went 180 degrees and, you know, accused Mitch Daniels of ignorance and censorship and not understanding how history is written. Hmm. So to attack Zinn is sacrilegious in leftist academia. Up to now, I don't think that students who were fed this stuff or parents or the general public had something that would rebut what Howard Zinn is saying. So I try to lay it out. And so every time he makes a misstatement or he plagiarizes or he quotes out of context or just lies, I come back and with other sources with my original research and expose that. He is not a legitimate historian or a scholar. He is a communist propagandist.
You can enjoy the entire conversation with Mary Graybar at ChristianOutlook.com. Coming up, tear it down.
But how many of those statues are actually of anti-racist kind of folks?
But do we really know what's being torn down? When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment, stay with us. This COVID-19 crisis is straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Georgine Rice. Tear it down. As we look at statues and monuments across the country, that seems to be the mood of the moment, at least from today's would-be revolutionaries. And there seems to be little rhyme or reason. In fact, some of it is clearly at odds with the professed goal of the protesters. One can discern a professed goal. In Massachusetts, there's a memorial to the Massachusetts 54th Voluntary Regiment. That regiment was composed entirely of Black American soldiers, the nation's second all-Black regiment in its history. They served the cause of the Union honorably in the Civil War. And yes, the memorial was defaced in recent protests. As an African American, I find that highly offensive and also telling. Eric Metaxas turned to the historian David Barton, a man who has specialized in America's founding.
We are having a tough time in this country. There are a lot of people trying to tear down history. There are mixed motives. It's complicated. There are always two sides to the issue. But what's your opinion of what's happening right now?
Well, this is a great illustration of how little we know about our own history. As you look at, I'm just surprised, even as I see statues coming down, not just those related to Independence Day, but how many of those statues are actually of anti-racist kind of folks. I mean, to tear down the Mass 54th statue, oh my gosh. I mean, that's the second Black regiment in the Civil War. To tear down the statue in Minnesota of the guy, it's a monument to those who were lynched, racially lynched. They're tearing that down. They're just tearing anything down.
Can we explain that? Now I'm confused because I had not heard.
Grant Monument? That's crazy.
I hadn't heard about the first two that you mentioned. Where are they? And tell us a little bit more about those. The Massachusetts 54, what is that? Sorry.
The Mass 54th is a monument in Boston, and the Mass 54th was a Black regiment in the Civil War that fought for liberty. It was founded by Frederick Douglass, one of two regiments he founded. And so Frederick Douglass recruited Black men to go fight for their own freedom and liberty. It was a very significant unit. It fought in the Battle of Fort Wagner. That's where actually the nation learned, hey, Blacks and whites are equal. These guys are great soldiers. They're great warriors. Let them fight. And so the Mass 54th became a very significant unit and a monument in Boston to the Mass 54th, which is a monument of equality, was attacked and defaced. But we're seeing that going across there. By the way, they're tearing down the statue of Abraham Lincoln in Boston as well. Now, tell me how Abraham Lincoln is a racist in any way, shape, fashion, or form.
Well, look, he's a white guy.
The statue of Abraham Lincoln.
He's a white guy. And if somebody's crazy enough to use that as their arbiter, that makes sense. But when you're talking about the Mass 54th, my question is, how is it possible that anyone could do that? I mean, it's one thing if somebody is unhinged and they're doing irrational things, but this is a level of irrationality. You always look for the thread of rationality within the irrationality. I can understand if somebody, as I say, tears down Grant or Lincoln out of pure ignorance that these were white leaders and we want to tear them down just because we're being vague and sloppy. But can anyone explain, did anyone explain why they would tear down the statue of Massachusetts 54th? And two other quick questions. Is this the regiment that was in the movie Glory with Denzel Washington and Matthew Broderick? And then the third question is, why I'm stunned the media hasn't reported on this. I've never heard about this until just now when you said it. So that's like the biggest news of all, that nobody's reporting on this.
Yeah, it is. And by the way, this is the regiment that was in the movie Glory. So this is the one that was featured there. This is a breakthrough unit in the Civil War that really kind of brought equality to the military. So you have that. The reason they're doing this, the best I can say, is they're completely ignorant of history because they're tearing down so many racial equality advocates. And they just don't know who they are. They just assume if it's a statue, it's a bad deal. And, you know, the same thing I would point to, I mentioned that monument in Minnesota. It's erected to honor those who died from lynchings. It's a monument against racial injustice, and they deface that and tear down a monument against lynching. I mean, it is crazy. So what you're seeing is this is a display of American education at work, because these people know nothing about history, one side or the other. They're responding to sound bites and memes and phrases, and this has no thinking behind it.
I want to be clear. We're not talking about Black people tearing down statues. We are talking about all kinds of people tearing down statues, most of whom, it seems to me, mm-hmm. are white, Antifa, Marxists, Black Lives Matter advocates who are, in fact, Marxists, who have hijacked this moment of strife in America. There are people who are sloppily, or I would say actually in this case, evilly, intentionally hijacking something that needs attention to just cause chaos. And the examples that you've just given, I'm just aghast that the media has not reported on these, David. So how is it that this came to your attention? Because this is the craziest thing I have heard of all this crazy stuff.
I have a running list of all the statues that are being defaced and torn down, all the memorials that are being attacked. It's crazy stuff. I mean, anything that is a memorial right now is under attack. The World War I Memorial, the World War II Memorial, the Abraham Lincoln Memorial, the Armenian Genocide Memorial, the Pioneer Fathers of Oregon, the Founders of University of Oregon, they tore those statues down. I mean, anything that's a statue right now has got to go. And so I keep a list, running list of all the statues that are being torn down, and I keep pictures of them. I file that away. It is amazing. All of American history is under attack right now, and they're extremists. But what's interesting is the media is not calling them out for it. The media is not highlighting the ridiculous things they're doing. And so they're really kind of justifying this as the anger and rage that stems from racial injustice, systemic racism, et cetera. But it's way beyond that. It is way beyond any of that discussion. And so what's happening is we're comparing our standards of today and trying to impose them back. And let me explain why that matters, because you wrote the book on Wilberforce. We have 5,500 years of recorded history at the time of Wilberforce. England is the first nation in the history of the world to abolish slavery, and we're talking 1833. People think abolition and equality has been the state of the world all the way through. We're talking recent America, 1865, when we passed the 13th Amendment, 1865, we were the fourth nation in the world to abolish slavery. So abolition is a relatively new thing in the world. And by the way, there are 94 nations in the world today where slavery is still legal. So half the world still has legal slavery, and we're all concerned about America and how that we had racism in 1865. It took us that long to abolish slavery. No, we're one of the leading nations in the world in shooting for equality. We were not late to the party. We were early to the party, number four in the world. And by the way, we were number one in the world in passing a law to abolish the slave trade.
Coming up,
there is no question that Christian faith shaped the way that Abraham Lincoln approached the enemy and trying to reconcile them at the end.
More with David Barton when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. The Lincoln Memorial is another key historic monument that was defaced during recent protests. In addition, protesters were threatening to tear down a statue of Lincoln with an emancipated slave. A statue, by the way, that was paid for by emancipated slaves. Well, Lincoln remains a model for the magnanimity he showed the South, particularly the soldiers of the Confederacy after the Civil War. Let's return to Eric Metaxas with historian David Barton.
It seems to me that Lincoln was particularly Christian in the way that he dealt with his defeated enemy in the Confederacy. When he gives his second inaugural, he talks about with malice toward none. There was a grace and a grandeur in the grace and graciousness in the way that he dealt with his defeated enemy in the Confederacy. And I submit to you that that is a part of the reason that he and Grant allowed many of these Confederate monuments to stand, because they said, we don't want to shove this in their face. We don't want a scorched earth policy. This is not Sherman's march to the sea. We're going to treat these people with some dignity, which really has always been the American way, certainly the Christian way. And that's why a lot of these monuments are up.
Yeah, there's no question that Christian faith shaped the way that Abraham Lincoln approached the enemy and trying to reconcile them at the end, because he tried to keep them reconciled. We had the split. He tried to bring them back. He did all sorts of things that probably we think he shouldn't have gone that far, but he was trying to reconcile. And so that passage out of 1 Corinthians about a ministry of reconciliation, he took very seriously. And by the way, we have a great letter written by the pastor of Abraham Lincoln talking about how Abraham Lincoln came to faith very late in life and how the pastor mentored him and how that shaped what he did. So as he's coming into the presidency, he's still a fairly young, zealous Christian who has really studied the Bible very thoroughly. And I think that really did affect what happened with him. We have testimony from even clergy that it was first in 1863 when Lincoln professed openly that profession of faith in Christ. He had come to faith earlier, but he first professed it in 1863. And then you see that 1864 second inaugural address. Oh, my gosh, it's better than many sermons we'll ever hear in our lifetime. It's more biblical. So I think you're exactly right, Eric. It was his biblical view that brought him to act the way he did and try to have some grace and accommodation for an enemy that had been defeated. The final thought is that a biblical view is what solves most of these problems. A secular view does not. And so the combination of understanding the weaker brother and what offends them, from a Christian standpoint, I want to help that. But at the same time, I still want truth. And balancing those two is the real difficulty America has today.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. For the complete conversation with David Barton, go to our website, ChristianOutlook.com. Thanks for joining us. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Posehn, Mike Cook, and James Blend, I'm Georgine Rice. May your celebration of our nation's independence be blessed this weekend. And may we find some measure of shared appreciation in the good gift that is the United States of America. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook.